first, live from our Cork studio at the Republic of Work in Cork. Delighted to say this morning we are joined by Dr. Colm Henry, who is Chief Clinical Officer with the HSE. Colm, good morning.
Good morning.
And thanks very much for dropping into our studio in Cork. Before we talk about some of the stories that are in the papers and exactly what we might be looking at a couple of weeks or months down the line, what is the HSE's general message this weekend when we see yesterday the highest number of individual COVID-19 cases reported since the middle of May?
Well, as you commented on earlier, we don't want to react in a very reflexive way to individual figures, but we have seen a slow and steady increase in cases since we had a low of cases in June. At that time, we had our instance or 2 week instance was 3 per 100,000, and now it's 33 per 100,000, and that's largely as a result. It's not surprising, really, that after the lockdown was released and people began to engage with each other again, that we saw more transmission. But the story since the end of June has been one largely fed initially by large outbreaks spreading and seeding into the community with a larger number of smaller outbreaks in household settings. And inevitably, this will result in increased community transmission. And as you referenced Bill Turmey there, he's absolutely correct. The single biggest risk to all of us, to education, to schools, to vulnerable groups, to older people, to restarting healthcare services, is widespread community transmission. That level is stable at the moment, but higher than we'd like, and we have to work to get it down. So the message is to people is to double up on those well-learned lessons of the past 6 to 7 months of washing hands, keeping distance, wearing a mask in appropriate settings.
Is there a danger that all of those common sense measures, things which have been the foundation of the public response for the last 6 months now, can sometimes be, you know, clouded, or that people can forget about them because there's so many other mixed messaging or confusion around the ethos of the policy, that you can meet in certain groups in some places but not in others, or all the row about pubs? Is that taking away from the ability to communicate those messages of reduce your contacts and wash your hands?
There's always distractions, Gavin, but I suppose when you look at the first phase that we faced way back in February and March, there was huge fear, and that fear drove us together with a common sense of purpose. And there now is understandably a great sense of fatigue. But unfortunately, the virus doesn't feel emotions, and it hasn't changed. It's every bit as transmissible now as it was then. And quite predictably, we're seeing a small trickle of increase in hospitalizations, 48 today with 6 patients in ITU, and a small but steady increase in the number of older people. And this is a reminder how transmissible this virus is. It hasn't changed. Sequencing of the virus elsewhere hasn't shown any mutation to make it any less vicious or virulent than it was before. So I'm afraid that the message is the same one of doubling up on those measures.
Just on that last point of that, you're not seeing any signs of any mutation, because there were some people who think that the fact that we now have increased levels of cases but not necessarily the same increase in hospital transmissions means that maybe there might be a slightly weaker or second strain of it going around. That's not your experience.
There are other much more plausible explanations. If you look at the cases we get are a function of who we test. At the beginning of this, in the phase one, if you like, of this pandemic, we tested people who had symptoms. And so the number of positive cases was largely driven by people who were sick, who were presenting with symptoms. As the number of people with symptoms nosedived, if you like, towards the end of June, we then began to test more strategically. Serial testing of healthcare workers in nursing home settings, for example, revealed a very low positivity rate of just over 1%. Serial testing in meat factories, 0.3%. So the number of cases we have now are driven by a different type of testing. But that doesn't mean the virus has changed at all. As I said, it's every bit as transmissible as it was at the beginning. Mm.
But what we are seeing, though, because there has been more targeted blanket testing for people who live in direct provision, I know that it hasn't quite gone as quickly as we meant to, but there's also been blanket testing of people in meat plants. What we have seen is a lot of cases where people are being now confirmed as carrying the virus, but they weren't necessarily showing any symptoms. Now, I don't want to write them off as being not a concern, but we do know that non-symptomatic people are far less likely to pass it on. So people will perhaps wonder whether, because we are now actively trying to chase down a lot of these cases and we're finding the virus in people who otherwise might not pose much of a threat to others, that maybe there might be a sense of overreaction to all of this. How would you respond to that?
I don't, as I repeat myself again, it's every bit as transmissible as it was. We know from the cases we do on contact tracing. So when we identify a case, whether somebody is symptomatic or whether it's through a mass screening exercise, and we trace the contacts, we find many of them have no symptoms. In the meat factories, for example, many of those cases identified as positive cases had no symptoms. In contact tracing, and you will have heard our worries in the past few weeks over over the incomplete, if you like, uptake of people for contact tracing is that many of those cases are asymptomatic who are positive. So we are not, you or I or anybody out there, are not the best judge themselves as to whether or not they have the virus or whether or not they can catch it. Only the tests can tell you so. So my urge to everybody would be if they're found to be a contact is get tested, because you are not the best judge yourself as to whether or not you are positive.
It is only the start of September, but we've already seen the notable trend this week as hospitals have returned to offering the full suite of services that hospitals would do in any other time. That capacity is becoming a little bit of an issue. I'm looking at the figures for last night. There were 568 vacant beds in hospitals, which is obviously a fairly healthy amount for a Saturday evening, but it is only a fraction of the overall hospital cohort of about 4,000 beds or so. If you look at intensive care, there's only 46 vacant beds, which doesn't necessarily give you an awful lot of wriggle room if there were to be a significant second wave. Would it be fair to summarise that it would take a far lesser second wave to pose a serious threat to hospitals than the first wave would have been?
Well, bear in mind during that first wave and during the lockdown, particularly from the end of March onwards, we closed all non-essential services. So the usage of ITU, the usage of acute beds, was driven largely by urgent emergency and COVID work. And quite understandably, people would expect us to begin to reopen those services, because we're seeing waiting lists accrue, we're seeing more and more people waiting for diagnostic tests. And we're getting more and more evidence of the harm caused to people by lockdown. We had a fairly stark report from our paediatric programme there last week, which you may have seen, Gavin, which showed the huge harm done to children's education, to their health and well-being, to screening programmes in schools as a result of the lockdown. And we've increasing stories from our delivery system hospitals in older people of malnutrition, of defunctioning, of immobility and unaddressed illness presenting later, if you like, in older people. So we must reopen our hospitals, we must reopen our ITU beds to other non-essential work, but work that is nevertheless needs to progress, otherwise people will present at a later time in their illness.
No, sure, now, but the point I was really trying to get at is that we don't have very much spare capacity in the system right now, and if there is still a latent amount and a growing cohort of COVID-19 patients who are going to need to be sent to hospital, and that's before we get anywhere close to a winter flu season, then the point I'm making is that we'd need very little to send us back to concerns about the hospital system being totally overwhelmed.
Absolutely. And we cannot face an overwhelmed hospital system, and we cannot face levels of congestion in our emergency departments that we saw in previous years. And for this reason, we're focusing on avoiding people getting to hospital. And our winter plan, which is being finalised at the moment, is looking at the development of community assessment hubs being refashioned to look at people with respiratory disease presenting in the community. We're also looking at adding to our hospital capacity. We have an additional 400 acute beds this year. We're plans to create a further 800 between this year and next year. In Limerick, for example, which has faced very difficult scenes for clinicians and for patients working there in recent years, we hope to have 100 beds open by the end of the year. In addition, in my own work as a clinician, as a geriatrician, what's really important to me is we're not just focusing on acute beds, we're focusing on re-enablement, on getting people healthy, back home, independent. And for this reason, we're also focusing on rehabilitation, on building up beds outside the hospital system where we can transfer older people to recover actively and return independently to their homes. So clearly part of the in building capacity, we're also looking at the private hospital deal, which we used during the first phase of this crisis.
Yeah, there's a story again today in the Business Post about how you wouldn't intend to basically renationalise them the way that they were. Is there some scope to maybe just at least buy or rent the extra services that you need on a day-to-day basis perhaps?
Well, that first deal was a creature of its time. We were looking at appalling scenes in Bergamo and Wuhan and even closer to home in London. And for that reason, we effectively almost nationalised the private hospital system for a short period of time. Fortunately, we didn't have to lean into that system as much as we were worried we might have to at the beginning. But now we're looking at a more nuanced deal, negotiating individually hospitals. If you like, an insurance policy for a surge capacity we may need if we see big numbers of COVID-19 presenting. But also, and equally, if not more importantly, to help us in catching up on those waiting lists that accrued during that closed down period. Mm. And particularly in that high-end work, specialist work, which is greatly threatened whenever we see surges of activity in our acute hospitals.
Is there any plan afoot to try and increase the number of permanent public ICU beds? Because I know that obviously around the time that we were experiencing the peak of the first wave, there was an increase in the number of intensive care beds that were made available. But as I understand it, that included a lot of, for example, surgical theatres, which weren't being used otherwise because there wasn't much elective work being done. If you look at the figures now, it seems that the total number of critical care beds we have isn't that much higher than it was before the outbreak. And I'm wondering, is there any plan afoot to try and increase that on a long-term basis?
Of course there is. And our level of ITU beds was far too low before we knew this. It was a 225 per year. It is an expensive service, a very specialist service, but one which is absolutely essential in any modern healthcare system. And it was far too low at 225. So we've built that considerably just before the crisis and during the crisis. And we have submitted a plan to government hoping to expand that over the coming years up to 500 in line with what international metrics would be for ITU beds.
So it would be over double what it was before COVID arrived.
Yeah, well, we're now reaching a level of 370 or so, of which we have, thankfully, we have some capacity today. But ITU beds are not just beds or ventilators; they're a system of care which depend greatly on the expertise and training of the nurses and doctors who staff them. And might I just say, the Intensive Care Society had a very useful meeting yesterday. They also raised almost 100,000 for healthcare charities related to COVID, and they've been extremely supportive of the community throughout all this crisis, highlighting the importance of public health in reducing numbers rather than depending on ITU beds alone, which are a precious commodity for those who are most sick.
Just to bring you back, you mentioned the negotiating with individual private hospitals to maybe take on their capacity. A lot of concern was expressed that while the premise of the original deal was good, and thankfully we didn't need the capacity that was ultimately rented from them, but it did disrupt the ordinary care that was delivered to people who are everyday patients in those private hospitals, people who were getting elective procedures that they didn't want to stay on the public list for as long for. Would there be similar knock-on concerns that if you did have to go back to a world where you were renting the use of private hospitals on a case-by-case basis, that you could still end up then having negative impacts on those who are everyday customers there?
You know, while I'm obviously concerned for anyone whose care is disrupted, my own concern as Chief Clinical Officer of HSE is for the whole population in terms of disruption of care. And while any disruption to the care of patients at private hospitals, you know, nobody wants that to happen. I'm also aware of the huge disruption to care for public patients in public hospitals as a consequence of the lockdown and the suspension of non-essential activity. So whatever deal we have with individual hospitals, we will want to address the needs not just of patients whose continuous care depends on private hospitals, but of our own patients in public hospitals who are on waiting lists, who are waiting for scopes, who are waiting for high-end surgery, who need time-dependent care such as chemotherapy or cardiovascular intervention. They're the kind of things we'd be focusing on.
Okay. One last thing that I want to ask you before you go, and you might be aware of some commentary around this in the last couple of days, which is the idea that the daily release of COVID-19 stats and the particular sort of format that it takes where it's announced every evening, that it does cause a bit of anxiety. And I know that part of that is to do with a lack of context where people aren't necessarily told that the Saturday and Tuesday figures are always going to be busier or higher because of the way that they're all structured. But there seems to be this growing concern that if you have the figures released every day, that people end up sort of living from day to day, that a high figure causes them to be more concerned than they ought to be, that a low figure causes them to be more lax than they need to be. Where do you stand on that? Could there maybe be something better around the pattern of communication, or maybe the nature of what is released from day to day, that could help to address that?
Now, I completely recognise that argument, and it's for me, it's much more important for us to focus on what is positive and what is hopeful rather than figures which may create a sense of despondency, especially in people who are suffering the greatest, such as those who are in isolation and older people who feel completely abandoned and sidelined by what has happened. And so what I would feel is we need to... There is much uncertainty here, Gavin. We can't be sure. We're in an unknown environment now in the months ahead. What we do know is that the interventions of the Irish people in that phase one, coming together as one mehel, as one people with a common sense of purpose, brought us down to single figures per day at the end of June. What I would like to see is, in my role, is to see that same sense of common purpose applied, that we all adhere to those well-learned messages, those well-learned lessons, so we can protect older people and not create some kind of apartheid in society where there's one set of rules for older people and another set of rules for younger people, and also get our schools back on track. So we need to redouble our efforts. A common sense of purpose. We're not just trying to avoid Bergamo or trying to avoid Wuhan. We're trying to open society up again. We're trying to live with COVID, but in a different way than we lived before.
maybe a bigger message that's worth digesting on. Colm Henry, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us this morning live from our Cork studio at the Republic of Work. That is Dr. Colm Henry, the Chief Clinical Officer of the HSE.